New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
And it is 7 p.m., WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Up next, Talk Out of School with Lainey Hampson.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math.
My name's Lainey Hampson. Welcome to our show, Talk Out of School, on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, where we focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City, the state level, and nationally. Our show is also available for download as a podcast. My guest this week is Laura Papano, the author of an important new book, School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. Laura will explain what's behind the rise of right-wing parent groups intent on banning books and the discussion of race and gender in our schools, and who claim that our classrooms have become indoctrination centers for radical, even communist ideas. But first, some local education news. The City Council Education Committee will hold a hearing on February 29th at 1 p.m. on the proposals of the class size working group that the chancellor appointed and what the DOE is doing are not doing to comply with the new state law that requires them to be lowering class size in all grades. I'll put links to the report of the working group and also how you can sign up to testify at this hearing. There will also be a press conference beforehand at noon on the steps of City Hall. State budget hearings were held in Albany last week, and both Chancellor Banks and Mayor Adams were grilled separately on their budget cuts to schools and their failure to move forward with an actual plan to lower class size. Some legislators said their failure to do so could affect their position on renewing mayoral control. I'll put news clips about these hearings also in the resources section. My written testimony to the legislature described how the DOE has not only increased class size for the last 2 years, despite the additional $1.3 billion they've received from the state in foundation aid, but also how the mayor's proposed budget cuts to schools in the capital plan will lead to likely lead to even sharper increases in class size in the future. Speaking of mayoral control, we also submitted comments last week to the state education department, countering the myths surrounding the system of one-man rule and how little real accountability is provided despite Eric Adams' claims otherwise. You can also check out the presentation I gave to the Education Committee of the New York City Bar Association on Tuesday night on the history of school governance in New York City. I'll put links in these links to these presentations in the resources section as well. The governor proposed that in the budget, due April 1st, mayoral control should be renewed for 4 more years. But some of the legislators, especially Senator Liu, the chair of the New York City Education Committee, said this was inappropriate. After all, mayoral control has little to do with the budget, and the state education department was tasked by the legislature to summarize the results of the recent hearings and to report back with a comprehensive review of the effectiveness of mayoral control by March 31st. So I do not think that this issue will be resolved until after that occurs. But now I want to turn to my guest, Laura Papano, who's written a fascinating new book on the rise of right-wing parent activism, groups that are trying to limit what schools can teach and what books students can read. The book is called School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. Laura, welcome to Talk Out of School.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
First, can you tell me a little bit about your own background and what led you to write this book?
Sure. I mean, I am a product of public schools. And in fact, I, in high school, was a member of my local school board as a student rep in New Milford, Connecticut. And what led me to write this is that I've covered education for over 30 years. I've written an education column for the Boston Globe. I've written about K-12 and higher ed, I've written especially for higher ed for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the USA Today through the Hechinger Report. I did a story last in December for Vanity Fair and the Hechinger Report on North Idaho. So I have been focused on education for a very, very long time. And what I noticed a couple of years ago was that there was a lot happening around schools, but it wasn't about education. So I felt compelled to dig in and connect the dots because some of the things I was hearing just made absolutely no sense.
Though the book focuses mainly on recent developments in parent activism, it also contains an interesting history of parent involvement in education policy, starting with the National Congress of Mothers and PTAs at the turn of the century, that explicitly took political positions on a variety of issues. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have also written a lot about gender over my course of my career. And it wasn't lost on me and has never been lost on me that moms, women are often the kind of invisible glue and workers in schools. They're the ones who make things run and operate. And I found it very interesting when I was digging into the historic piece, and I'd known about this, but I more explicitly did some research up at Harvard's Guttman Library with a fantastic librarian who was super helpful. And what before women could get had the right to vote, there was this kind of understanding that women were quote unquote experts in the home and motherhood. And therefore, they were often in a number of districts given the right to either vote for school board or to even run for school board. Not everywhere. And there was even an interesting clash where those working for the suffrage movement found that that would be a distraction because if women got kind of partial voting rights, that it would damage the real effort. But what you saw was out of that, this kind of this development where women used their quote unquote expertise with schools, homes, children to extend the reach of the home. And there were some who even thought that women should extend the reach of the home throughout the world as a way of just, in a way, gaining some kind of power and authority. But what happened relative to schools was that you had these groups who were really focused on the betterment of children, parenting expertise. They could get carried, away and go a little overboard on the parenting expertise. But what they did do is that they recognized that one reason students, when we started having the rise of common schools, one reason students didn't attend is they didn't have clothing. So they organized clothing drives. They were often not attending because they were hungry or didn't have food. They organized food. Moms organized and they advocated for immunization, school lunches, mandatory school attendance. A lot of these things, and we're seeing some kind of interesting issues rise up again around, you know, child labor and school attendance. So they really played a really critical role. And I just found that so kind of so interesting and so apt. And I read old magazines back from the, you know, 1910s, looking at the duties and the efforts, and they were highly, highly organized.
Now, most of the book is focused on more recent developments and especially the growth of new parent organizations that have taken an aggressively hostile posture towards our public schools, spreading distrust and anger at how they supposedly indoctrinate children in all sorts of ways. You explain that the growth of these organizations was in part sparked by mask mandates during the pandemic. Can you explain?
Sure. So what I would say is that there has always been an undercurrent of far-right activism that has looked at schools as a really juicy target, if you will. But what happened during COVID was that suddenly you had people showing up at meetings objecting to mask mandates, and people found one another. And in that finding one another, they created organizations. I mean, that is essentially how Moms for Liberty got started. And we have to remember that that was a time where it wasn't good for anybody. There was a lot of emotion, a lot of frustration. Nothing was really working well for very many people at all. So it was very easy to then target our public schools and public education, which, having covered, again, public schools for 30 plus years, there, I mean, what have I written about all that time? Issues, problems, challenges, you know, reading challenges, math challenges. I mean, there are so many issues in public schools to begin with. So it was a very easy way to corral emotion and organize people in opposition to schools was to say, well, here's, you know, it's the public schools are the problem. The teachers are the problem. The leaders are the problem. The librarians are the problem. Look at these things that are happening. And there is a longer history to this, which is that that parental rights, well, I guess we'll get into that a little bit later with the Christian nationalism, but there is a longer arc here. But more specifically to your question, COVID just was this match that lit the fuse.
So as you mentioned, Moms for Liberty, which is probably the best known of these organizations and which has been identified as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Leadership Center, they recently claimed they had more than 300 chapters in 48 states, though this is difficult to confirm. But they have grown very, very fast. You attended their first national summit in July 2022. Can you describe the summit and the sort of issues that they've latched onto?
Yes. So I was there, I think it was June 2022 in Tampa, Florida, hot, humid, and the kind of interesting, curious irony to the whole thing was that right across the street from the hotel where they were holding their summit was what was being was the Tampa Convention Center, which was having what they billed as the Florida's largest anime convention. So on the one hand, you had the Moms for Liberty in the hotel, and you had people walking around with feathers and glitter and wigs and colonial garb. So it was just quite some contrast. Now, I registered using my, you know, I registered my name and I did.
And not as a reporter, right? Not as a member of the media.
I was writing a book, so I didn't feel the obligation to do that. Mm-hmm. And I also, when I walked in there, I didn't know what I would find or how much I would use or what I would use. So, but I did dress to fit in. I wore a red blazer. I had an American flag pin pinched into my lapel. White shirt and blue slacks. And I attended all 4 days of the summit. And as a journalist, I have been in many, many settings in which, I may not personally agree and often I don't even run that through my head. I just go and I listen. And what struck me is that I walked into that summit, 500 people in a big ballroom at the Marriott, and I expected to be confused. I expected to hear things that were going to make me go, that's interesting. It was anything but. From the moment the whole summit opened, it was just extremist language. I mean, hearing that sending your children to public school for 30 to 35 hours a week was akin to sending them to a Maoist reform prison camp, that social emotional learning was a form of Marxism. And I had written about social emotional learning years ago in my Boston Globe column, education column. So I was hearing over and over things that made absolutely no sense to me. And it was, and it's that that made me really think about, well, what's really going on here, right? And it became very clear that the public schools were being used, these public schools that are nonpartisan spaces. I went to school. I never knew what the politics of any of my friends were. As a parent, I didn't know what other parents' political views were, and it did not matter. But suddenly, I was looking at these nonpartisan spaces becoming tools for a far right effort at power, far right effort to take over and to scare people. And that was in that piece, that scare, that the language of fear was a big part of this. And that was what struck me in that first convention, in the first summit, was over and over, there was this narrative of your moms, you're not used to stepping up and being in the spotlight. You're not used to showing up at school board meetings. You're not used to running for office. But your children are in danger. And what do moms do when their children are in danger? They will do anything. And is that idea of harm, the idea that the very educators who we depend on to really help us raise our children and educate our children, causing harm, which I just struck me as just a really, you know, underhanded tool, underhanded approach to gaining power. And that, and I must admit, it outraged me. The idea that I've covered education for all these years and that schools, we could disagree about, are you serving all students? Are you, you know, what are your policies? How are you handling IEPs? I mean, there are so many issues, but this was not about that. This was, hey, we're going to make this a political platform. And that I felt was needed to be, you know, challenged.
So there's a right-wing organization called the Leadership Institute that sponsored the conference that you went to that also offers free training for parents to run for school board. Do they have an underlying ideology that you could discern? And what do they intend to achieve through these trainings? What's the real motivation behind them?
Right. Well, the Leadership Institute was started in 1979 by Morton Blackwell as an institute to train conservatives. And if you dig back into the history a little bit, what you notice is that in the late 1970s, the Heritage Foundation, another far right conservative group, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the Leadership Institute, these far right groups are founded. And what's interesting is when you look at what was happening around kind of religious conversation at that time, you look at the fact that religion and religious organization was often in the past apart. They didn't want to mess with the dirty world of politics. But then you saw a shift. You know, you start to see the shift around this time when the language changed and the language of the far right and the language of the religious groups, Christian nationalism, became more secular. And that's where you start hearing children, you know, students' rights, AIE, that's the new way of talking about, we want prayer in schools, parents' rights. That's the new way of talking about we want control over what's happening in schools. So suddenly the language was adopting the kind of secular language of kind of the liberal lexicon about rights and protections. And so you see that get flipped. So the Leadership Institute, you know, was one of those that began recognizing, and I think thanks to the Moms for Liberty, who came out and were very, very, they offered these groups a way of framing their battle that they just, I don't know, they just had not had before. So you have moms saying, our children, our liberty, our parent rights, we're willing to fight for them. So it's a whole different way of talking about what's happening in school. And so, you know, the result is that you have this kind of coming together of far right political groups that have long sought ways to gain more power. And then you have the moms. And what I noticed at that first conference was that At that moment, the Leadership Institute had not yet started training school board members. For the longest time, school boards were not really worthy of attention. But it was at that summit that I started seeing that change. Ron DeSantis stood up on the stage and he said, for the first time ever, I am going to endorse 30 school board candidates. And throughout the entire summit, over and over, if you are running for school boards, please stand up, applause, over and over and over. So the messaging was that these were the heroes in our midst. And when I was looking at it, the women who were standing up were utterly flattered that Ron DeSantis was endorsing them. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I'm like, no, the reverse is true. Ron DeSantis is gaining all of their networks, and moms have wonderful networks. And outside the ballroom, there was the Noah Webster Institute. And I was talking with one of the representatives at the table there who had just literally started doing school board trainings and was, and I always thought of the Noah Webster group as a kind of a sleepy conservative organization. And suddenly I was told they had 600, 700 people signed up for their trainings. And if you start looking around, you start seeing since that time, since that first summer of 2022, there are school board trainings. And I sat in on a Leadership Institute, one of their breakout sessions where they said, we will go anywhere you invite us, we will fly and go anywhere. And if you look at how much money they have raised and their 990s had more than doubled between 2017 and 2021. So they are well flush to be able to show up wherever there is call for them to do so.
So recently, Moms for Liberty even came to New York City. I don't know whether you read the news about
that. I saw the news clips of that, yes.
Yeah. So they held a meeting where there were probably more parents and elected officials protesting outside the hall rather than inside the hall. I think the only two political figures who attended were George Santos and Andrew Giuliani, son of Rudy Giuliani. According to Mother Jones, quote, they trotted out their go-to culture war talking points about gender ideology and diversity, equity, and inclusion, while also wondering aloud how education had become so political. So, you know, there's a certain hypocrisy in that they are the ones who are really focusing on the politics now. But another spark for the rapid growth of these organizations, you write, and I think this is also important to look at, was the backlash against the racial reckoning that this country was engaged in, especially following the killing of George Floyd, which had prompted diversity trainings and discussions about racism in schools throughout the country, that in turn has led to a really fierce backlash and attempt to ban these sorts of discussions. One of the people you write about in the book who has really been a leader in the opposition to diversity, equity, and inclusion is a fellow named Chris Rufo, who also has a tie to New York City because he's a fellow at the right-wing Manhattan Institute. Can you just a little bit explain who Chris Rufo is and how he's been leading this backlash across the country?
Well, Chris Rufo is, he's basically a conservative activist, and he started, he's actually also from Seattle, ironically enough, but he was the one who is really responsible first for making CRT a kind of boogeyman, but he has done it with—
Critical race theory is the—
So let's talk about critical race theory for a minute. So critical race theory is a legal construct, because when scholars, and Derek Bell wrote about this, a professor at Harvard wrote about, you know, there was this problem that despite court decisions, despite civil rights laws, despite desegregation policies, racial injustice continued. And it wasn't a judgment about the racial injustice. It was, okay, how do we begin to apply and understand why this keeps happening legally if we have had all of this quote unquote progress. And that was, it was really critical race theory was not just what it is, but how it was used. And it was used by scholars to kind of make sense of what was going on. And yes, part of why the law keeps not working out is because there is racism embedded in our institutions. That's just part of how the law operates. But Chris Rufo thought that it would be way more useful to him to kind of take something that sounds, you know, that is a very specific legal and, you know, academic tool and make it broad. And what he did is he started changing it from critical race theory to make people really afraid of it. And I think one thing I just want to insert here is that critical race theory is not a tool to blame specific individuals or groups of individuals. So let's be clear before we even begin that that's not its aim. And yet that is in essence how it has been used. So when Christopher Rufo was, he started tweeting, he started redefining it. And he talked about, and he was very blatant in his, on Twitter, talking about, he said, the goal is to, he said, we, in March 2021, he bragged on Twitter. He said, we have successfully frozen their brand, critical race theory, into the public conversation and are steadily driving up negative perceptions. We will eventually turn it toxic. We put all the various cultural insanities under that brand category. This is a marketing tool. It is a far right political marketing tool. He said the goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. We have decodified the term and will recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions unpopular with Americans. So very clearly, a very specific agenda. And I think, and one of the things I did is one of my friends is professor of linguistics at Yale, Bob Frank, and I was talking with him about that. And he goes, well, we could run something to see when it became popular and how it tracked with all the appearances on Tucker Carlson. Lo and behold, the usage of CRT and critical race theory shot up right in parallel with this really marketing campaign that Chris Rufo organized around CRT. And the result is that we are really confused right now in America about how to talk about race in our education system. There are teachers across the country who are afraid to say things or unsure what they can or cannot say. We have state legislatures that have passed laws and are passing laws around, you know, quote unquote, divisive concepts, who are making it impossible to even understand what that is. And often in some of the legal, in some of the laws that have been passed, one of the goals is to make sure that white students don't feel discomfort. Two questions I have is one, what about Black students feeling discomfort, number one? And number two, who even knows when someone's feeling, how do you legislate discomfort? So it's this sort of thing where over and over, and we've seen this around in a number of areas that we can talk about, you know, social emotional learning, we just create this kind of unclear, rabid fear.
The boogeyman
around something that has long been part of our schooling, which is teaching about race and history. And now the very thing at a very moment when it's really critical, we are struggling to figure out how to do it. And I think one important thing that's important to note with all this is that when we look at our demographics, 90% of children in America attend public schools. In 1986, 70% of them were white. In 2020, 46% of them were white. By 2030, it's projected to be 43%. So we have a very, very different demographic in our public schools than we did a couple decades ago. And all of those students need to be included and educated, and they need to feel they belong. I honestly do not understand how inclusion has become a political issue. It makes no common sense.
So one of the things that you cite in your book is a survey of teachers, even as of spring 2022, one quarter of teachers reported that limitations placed on their ability to address topics related to race or gender have influenced their choice of curriculum and their instructional practices. And they are feeling very hamstrung and very afraid. You provide lots of examples of teachers who've been harassed and even lost their jobs because of teaching materials that were thought to be overly critical of aspects of U.S. history, for example. And the other thing that, of course, I think we've all heard about are the book bans that I believe are still growing across the country. And you write that there were apparently book bans being discussed in 86 districts in 26 states, and that in some states there were bills that held the librarians criminally responsible if they had the wrong sort of books in their libraries related to sexuality, race, social justice, and that librarians possibly could even be prosecuted for not limiting the sorts of books they had. Can you describe what happened, for example, in Central Bucks School District as example of one of these controversies?
Well, Central Bucks, and I'll throw another quick statistic out, and that's that the School Library Journal does, actually started in 2022, they surveyed librarians and asked them, it was an anonymous survey, and said, when are you self-censoring and removing kind of ahead of being asked any quote unquote potentially problematic books? 42% of librarians said that they were doing that. This year, 2023, that rose to 47%. So this is still a problem where teachers are avoiding teaching certain subjects because they fear the repercussions. There are librarians who are quietly, without book challenges, because there is and has long been a process in every district for handling books that you think are inappropriate on the shelves. There has long been a way of challenging books, but they are removing them kind of in a way to avoid that controversy out of fear, the self-censorship that we're hearing about. One of the heartening things I took from the School Library Journal survey, though, was that one third of librarians said they considered leaving the profession in reaction to the intensity of the book bans. But two-thirds said it has moved them to be more active in fighting censorship. So a good example, if we're talking about fighting back, is what you raise in Central Bucks. That school district had a very far-right board that limited what teachers could hang on their walls. It limited, there was a whole library use policy where parents would have to give permission for students to use certain materials, which included, I mean, there was confusion around whether or not this involved books with nudity that were art, you know, that were related to art. So there was a great deal of control sought by the school board over what the teachers could and couldn't do. There was a pronoun policy. They call it a gender identification policy. And I met with a teacher who, right after school one day, a high school teacher, who sat down across from me at a railroad, like a pub, and said, "I just about got fired today." And he said it rather boastfully and proudly. And it was because, and yet, like a classic teacher, I that piqued my interest, and I wanted to hear about this, but not before he'd given me his whole philosophy on teaching and how grades fit in, which is, that's what is, I mean, that's the beauty of teachers and teaching, is that they don't really want to engage in these politics. And yet here he was, and he said, I refuse to harm a child. He wouldn't say out loud, I'm not going to follow the policy, but it was very clear what he was saying. And what was interesting to me was that at around that time, I met Kate Nazemi, who was a co-founder with a retired high school English teacher. And they started Advocates for Inclusive Education. In fact, it was starting right when I was first in Central Bucks. And the work that they have done, not only along with other groups to flip the board back, but the work that they've done to inform, to dig into every policy and every policy repercussion and what's happening in the legislature. And they have done so much work to inform. I'm on their email list. I get emails. Don't forget to show up tomorrow night. This is what's being discussed. Please turn out. So the level of organizing and pushback that we're seeing by moms on the ground who are, you know, moms who might one, you know, at one time have been, you know, baking scones for the teacher appreciation breakfast or selling wrapping paper, are now digging into policies and legislature and making sure that people are registered to vote. I was in Brevard County, Florida yesterday, as I said, and a lot of the conversation that I was hearing was, how do we register high school students to vote? How do we get people to turn out? And voter turnout is huge. But that pushing back, what you describe there, is absolutely critical. And Bucks County is one of those places where the Moms for Liberty candidates were defeated. And that was taken as a, along with Penn Ridge, which had another extremist, that and even another story, but they were the, you know, one of the districts people pointed to and say, Moms for Liberty has lost their grip. But I when I was talking with Kate Nazemi a couple of weeks ago, I said, so do you guys, are you done? Have you solved the problem? She goes, absolutely not. She said, this is exactly when the opposition digs in and gets ready to come back the next year. And I think Kate's, I find her so wise, I must say. I love interviewing her. And she said something to me that I think is really useful for parent groups, which is she's really working hard and not resting. And she's trying to bring in and broaden their support for public schools and public education. And she, rather than fight on the terms that Moms for Liberty would like to fight, which is they're indoctrinating our children, they are do we have a problem?
No, I think it's okay. You froze for a moment, so go ahead.
But rather than arguing on their terms and in their language, you know, Kate said to me, she said, one thing is that I think we can all agree, everyone can agree, that we all deserve to be who we say we are. And I think that that is just such a beautiful framing of how we might move forward.
So this is Leani Hameson on Talk Out of School on WBAI FM radio. I'm speaking with Laura Papano about her important new book, School Moms, about the rise of right-wing activism among many parents, and also the pushback from parents who do not want schools to be divided and by politics, and to see restrictions on what can and cannot be taught in school. Throughout your book, you also suggest that there's a larger political agenda behind a lot of these organizations to sow such distrust about public schools and their supposed brainwashing of children to further their efforts to defund public schools and create or expand voucher systems in their place. Can you explain?
Absolutely. I mean, the end game here is to denigrate public schools so profoundly that people say, you know, they're just not doing the job, let's get rid of them. And we see that around the country with the whole push for the vouchers. And what's the vouchers, and also in the form of education savings accounts. So education savings account, like the ones in Florida and in Arizona and many other states that have adopted them. One of the keys is that they were meant as options for poor students, for special needs students, for people of very low income, and that this was really meant as an alternative. What they have done in raising the income caps on these around the country and opening them up is that they are essentially funneling public school dollars to people, in many cases in Arizona, a very high percentage who are already sending their children to public schools.
And private
schools. Thank you. And if you look at when I first was looking at the Arizona case, you know, the vouchers were worth, I think, about $7,500, $8,000. And the average private school in Arizona was $12,500. So only certain people are able to take advantage of these vouchers or education savings accounts. And yet they're being framed as, quote unquote, education freedom and parental rights. And all it really is moving the job of education from the community, from a communal task, to one where we'll give you some money and you see what you can do. I actually worry that we are going to have a whole segment of our population that is literally uneducated.
Yeah, what's so ironic about the push to vouchers? Well, first of all, these people who are attacking our public schools win either way. They win if they gain control of the public schools and censor what can and cannot be taught. They win also by spreading the fear among so many parents about what's happening in the public schools, that these parents want to pull their kids out and go to private schools. And what's really ironic is that many of the private schools that are going to then be funded by the government instead are openly indoctrinating kids, openly teaching religion, openly able to discriminate against all sorts of kids, including gay and trans kids and kids who don't conform to whatever they specifically want, you know, their children to be associating with. So the idea that somehow they're sowing all this anger and distrust is, I think, a part of the underlying strategy that they have for defunding our public schools. And you also connect the rise of these schools with white Christian nationalism. Recently, we're hearing more and more about white Christian nationalism. It was not a phrase that was well known to me until recently. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Absolutely. So it goes back to, and we started to talk a little bit about this when we were talking about the founding of the Heritage Foundation and the Leadership Institute and the Cato Institute. And one of the things that I appreciated was there's a scholar that I quote in the book, Matthew Moen, and he wrote several decades ago, but he's so smart. And he said at the time in the 70s, the power that the religious right was gaining was largely overlooked by politicians and journalists. And he said, people were tracking Jim Baker and Oral Roberts. He said, missed the distinction between mission and objectives. He said Baker was bent on building the ultimate Pentecostal amusement park, but Jerry Falwell had a mission to remake America. And it was, if you remember, we had Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority. And, you know, Falwell, by the way, was shocked when Jimmy Carter, who is a born-again Christian himself, said he would absolutely never sign a bill returning prayer to schools. So when we're talking about this kind of right, religious right, white Christian nationalist movement, we're not talking about, many of the people I interviewed are devout, involved religious Christians, but they are not white Christian nationalists with a political agenda. And yet religion is being used in, some of these people have pointed out to me, in very unchristian-like ways. to gain political power. And, you know, one of the things I was looking at something recently in the New York Times from 1985, and Fred Hechinger was writing about a North Carolina report that quoted Jerry Falwell as saying the following: "I hope I live to see the day when, as in the early days of our country, we won't have any public schools. The churches will have taken them over again, and Christians will be running them." 1985. This is exactly the challenge that we are facing now. If you look at the voucher expansion in Florida, and I did a story about a year ago, kind of looking at the consequences right as that was happening, before the voucher expansion, I looked at the data of what schools, what were the frameworks of the schools that were getting the vouchers. In Florida, only 4% were non-religious, not-for-profit, and accredited. So these, in some cases, these are money-making enterprises. These are ways of making money for real estate and developer type of people, and their money for churches and evangelical efforts. So, you know, what was striking about Falwell's moral majority, you know, by 1989, he had shut it down. And then you had Pat Robertson with his 700 Club, and he ran for president. And what was, and this is a key point, is that what Pat Robertson's did was they drew together people who may not have been in the same room religiously, but gathered them around political aims that they could agree on. And that was part of what allowed them to transform their language, you know, to move from kind of religious outrage. And, you know, if you read a lot of Jerry Falwell's moral majority, those newspapers, and I actually did read a whole bunch of them, there was a kind of like a moral outrage around behavior and schools and students and parenting. But this Pat Robertson and the Christian right, the religious right, moved into the more familiar and widely accepted language of liberalism, as I said before, with this focus on rights, equality, and opportunity. And they flipped the script. So then suddenly they're blaming cultural elites for bigotry and for discrimination against traditional values. And the strident campaign to put God back in government were transformed into these rallies to move sympathetic citizens and win elections for these things that they could all agree on. So it was. So I think of it as moving from the language of, you know, of persuading rather than preaching. And that's essentially what we're seeing. One of the kind of interesting things is that the Christian Coalition then started running some candidates and supporting candidates for office. They ran stealth candidates. And in 1992, the People for the American Way monitored religious right candidates and found that 40% of them won. And you even had, you know, cases in which in New York City school board races that candidates won. And some candidates were winning without even appearing in public before they were seated. So you have this really very kind of stealth approach. And then, mm-hmm. you know, and we've seen that, you know, think of it as like a trial run at something. But that is very much what's happening now, except now this white Christian nationalism is really meant as this to take over and run all sectors of, you know, government, society, to gain control.
To run the public schools, but to defund the public schools, to destroy the public schools. You describe one school budget fight in New Hampshire where after the school board actually cut the budgets of the public schools by 50%, which is probably the most radical budget cuts I've ever seen in my life. The citizens of the town organized and reversed the cuts and then gained control of the school board. Can you quickly just tell us that story?
Absolutely. That's Croydon, New Hampshire. And to be clear, this was not a Christian right group. They were free staters. So it was a different brand of
libertarian.
New Hampshire is home to, there's a free state movement where the idea was to have people move to New Hampshire and then get rid of laws and taxes and all of the things that, that were problematic.
I think their state education commissioner homeschooled all his kids and really doesn't even believe in public schools.
Yes, I know. It's very puzzling. But what happened in Croydon was that there in March, there's oftentimes snowstorms. And right as the three person board, which had two kind of one definite free stater, one free state sympathizer, and then a Tom Moore, who was doing his last board meeting, and he was a he taught shop in a school nearby, and he had made these kind of hand engraved pens for the other twos, and they had agreed on a budget and thought all was fine. And so he just thought when it started snowing, and he told his wife, don't bother coming to town meeting. And town meeting, this is a tiny town. The schools are the little red schoolhouse is K through four, and then it is sent out, and then it's tuition, kids' tuition out. But the point of it is it's a very old and valued part of the community. So he said, don't bother coming, it's going to be fine, this is just procedural. And so he did, so she stayed home, and then other people stayed home, and then suddenly someone stood up in a town meeting, which is kind of like a rugby form of government. It's kind of, you have to push your case. And they got rid of the budget. But this group of parents and citizens across the political spectrum got together, and they needed to get at least 50% of the 565 voters. Only 6% voted were there in March. But they got over 60% to show up in May, 66% to reinstitute the budget. And many of them are now in office or running for office. And one texted me yesterday that she is running for school board.
So we really have to wrap up in just a couple minutes, but I just want your projection for the future in terms of where we're going now. Are these groups on the wane? Are they still gaining power? How much should we worry about what's going to happen in the future?
Well, I think the good news is that when the Moms for Liberty summit happened in June 2022, there were hardly any protesters out there. When I spoke, I met yesterday with Liz Mkhitaryan, who started Stop Moms for Liberty. She didn't even have a group then. She said, because we didn't think it was real. We didn't think this could catch on. It did catch on, and people are wising up to it.
And so the lesson is pay attention.
Pay attention to
what's happening at your school board. Pay attention what's happening in your state legislature, because these people want to control what's taught and not taught in the schools. But even more, I think the underlying motive you've shown us is to defund and destroy our public schools and to, create a separate system of religious schools mostly, but all sorts of schools that will be free to indoctrinate children any way they want.
Absolutely. I think you've nailed it. I mean, I think this is it's worrisome, and we have to wake up and be vigilant, because these school board races where we get far right boards, in some cases, I saw them winning with 8 to 10% voter turnout.
Yeah. And sometimes there's only a 6% voter turnout on some of these races. Laura, thank you so much for being with us here tonight to talk about your important new book, School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics and the Battle for Public Education. I'll put a link to how you can buy the book in the resources section of WBAI and the podcast. And I really hope that you do. This is Leahni Hamson, host of Talk Out of School on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio. Our show is available as a podcast if you missed the live version or want to recommend it to a friend. Also, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or a special supporter of this show, Talk Out of School, by calling 212-209-2950. There's no other show on the air that deeply delves into the issues affecting our schools like this one. You can also contribute online at WBAI.org. We really need the support of listeners to keep going as one of the only non-commercial, purely membership-supported radio stations in New York City that doesn't run any ads. We will be back soon with another episode of Talk Out of School. Until then, be careful and be safe, and thanks so much for listening.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom ready to sell. If you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books. Keep it, the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around, you finally lay your burden down. Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the halls and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend.
Extinction Diaries. Zebras are starting to be born with strange spots or patterns not normal to them. Scientists believe this is likely from inbreeding. Research has revealed that most animals higher up on the evolutionary chain are instinctively not drawn to mate with a close relative. However, species suffering reduced numbers such as low as a dozen or herds with geographical constraints have no choice but to mate with a relative close enough to create genetic damage. Aberrations not related to inbreeding, like melanin mutation that alters pigment, are rare among mammals. So biologists are concerned that 5% or more of zebras around a Ugandan lake are striped abnormally. Habitat fragmentation is preventing regional herds from migrating, and some smaller groups are literally boxed in without any unrelated genetics. There are approximately 1.5 million wild zebras, and though that's not great, there remains significant genetic diversity overall. The problem now is likely specific groups finding themselves cut off from their distant relatives. My name is Aaron Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
WBAI is a local station board, the Pacifica Foundation board, responsible for local management and operations, is holding its next regular meeting on Wednesday, February 14th at 7 p.m. The LSB expects to be populating subcommittees and task forces at both the national and the local board level. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, February 14th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be held through the Zoom remote meeting service and is accessible to the public and includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar at kpftx.org and on the WBAI website. You can also gain access by calling 929-205-6099. That's 929-205-6099. And enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. Meeting ID again, 922-457-2995. And as if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. It's 995 and WBAI's frequency. So it's 995-995-99. You have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? No, but we certainly need you to. Thank you. Because we're going to a Harlem hospital in an episode of New World a Comin' with Canada Lee and Celeste Holm. We have Groucho Marx in Blue Ribbon Town with his guest Charles Lawton. We have an episode of The Candid Microphone with Alan Funt. And we'll begin, as we do every week, with our current episode of Gunsmoke. All coming your way next on the Golden Age Radio, so stay tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org.